General Aviation Flight Simulators. They may be overused at times, but when are they the perfect tool? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. Being Monday, it's time to talk with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We get together with Bob every Monday to talk about safety topics from his sometimes controversial viewpoints. Bob, thanks for joining us again today.
Well, as always, Paul, it's my pleasure to be with you.
You wrote in the March edition of Over the Airwaves about, you briefly touched on this, but I thought it was worthy of a more in-depth discussion, and that is how simulators, which you generally are not a big fan of in most situations, one of their greatest uses might be in training for partial panel operations. Tell us more about that.
Well, you are correct, Paul. Yeah, I am not a great fan of simulators, only to the extent that they're used in the place of real-world flying opportunities. We cannot simulate in a general aviation-level flight simulator the world around us. But flight simulators do have a very valuable role to play in certain aspects of flight training, one of which is in-flight emergencies and partial panel skills. We can do in flight simulators what we cannot do in real airplanes. We can create low oil pressure or no oil pressure situations. We can fail various instruments and then see how the student reacts, and then allow ourselves to evaluate how they react in an objective basis without putting anybody at risk. That's the plus side of the flight simulators.
You know, one of the things I remember back to the early days of Microsoft Flight Simulator, back in the 1980s, I remember the versions that ran under DOS, and I remember watching one of my friends use it, and there was a parameter you could set before the simulation began for reliability, and you could set it anywhere from 5 to 100%, I think, and I remember for fun, just one time he set it at 5%, and if you did that,
everything failed.
I mean, you'd get up in the air, and all of a sudden, just one by one, everything you needed was clicking off, and all of a sudden the gas all leaked out, and the instruments all failed, and the engine quit. And
I think I worked with that program, Paul.
Bob, your Cessna is almost that program lately, Bob.
I know. In that context, the GA Flight Simulator is a wonderful teaching tool, again, for partial panel. It's also a very effective tool for teaching instrument procedures, showing or demonstrating how to initiate a procedure turn or enter a hold or even fly an instrument approach. My objection to them is when I see perfectly great flying weather outside, or even weather where the level of turbulence is high, or even when the weather where the ceiling and visibility are low, and I look around at some flight schools and I see that the flight simulator is busy at work, when these are really opportune times to get students up in the air to experience real world flying conditions. To the FAA's credit, they have limited the amount of sim time that can be used towards meeting the requirements for various ratings. But we can use these devices to our advantage, and we can certainly use them to our disadvantage. But again, when the reliability factor is set something below 50% or 40%, or the sim operator begins to surreptitiously fail one system after another, that is a good learning experience and a great opportunity.
Let me ask you this philosophical question, Bob. Is it important to practice partial panel skills if you're a VFR pilot or student?
Well, yeah, I think learning to fly with all of the equipment not working at a given point in time is always very useful. Let me tell you about a flight I had last night. We were in VFR conditions. It was an instrument flight, but we were in VFR conditions, about ready to set up to do an approach. And my student, because of we had VFR conditions, was under a hood. And just as he was turning onto the localizer, the left lens of his glasses fell out. Literally fell right out of the frame.
And not enough electrical tape on him, right?
Could have been, but he had Coke bottle-sized lenses, and I knew he needed the lenses, and he says, I can't shoot this approach. He says, the lens just fell out on the floor, and I said, why can't we shoot it? He says, because the lens fell out. I says, no. I says, we got to shoot it. He says, oh, no, I can't. I says, well, what are you going to do if you're up here? by yourself, and the same thing happens. You're going to get out of the airplane and step off and climb the ladder back down to Earth. That was an example of a partial panel exercise that really had nothing to do with the airplane, but had something to do with... So is this a lesson for all of us who, like me, wear glasses or corrective lenses? Maybe we should go up there with a safety pilot and take those lenses off or take one of them out and practice flying the airplane without our glasses on.
Well, Bob, I know how you feel about foggles. Maybe this is a great opportunity to cut them in half and use them as a whole new tool. Because, you know, I've been in that situation driving sometimes, Bob, you know, what I did at the time, and frankly, my vision's not real great without glasses on, is I actually, closed one eye and pulled over and looked for it and didn't drive, you know, further until I put them back together. But if you have to fly with one eye, your depth perception becomes an issue, and especially, you know, on final approach, you have to maybe lean more on looking at that trapezoid where in the past you might have relied on depth perception. So that is, yeah. I guess that is kind of like a partial panel skill.
It is a partial panel skill, and I've had students who've, I lost a student one time who quit on me. He just fired me, in effect. He was a physician. He is a physician, and we were doing some instrument procedures, and I insisted at the last minute that he change the procedure to do something else, and he says, no, I don't want to do it that way. He says, I'm stressed out at work. I don't have time for this. I want to do what I pre-planned. I said, no, do what I've asked you to do. We've just suffered an engine failure, and you have to make an instrument approach to this other runway. He says, I don't want to do it. And I said, and we got on the ground, we talked about it, and he says, Bob, he says, you don't understand. He says, my life is full of stresses. I wasn't prepared to do that. You're fired, more or less. And I said at the end, in conclusion, I said, just what would you have done in the real world when under all of life's pressures you have a failed engine? Would you have shot that other approach? And he later came back. We're good friends today. We talked about it, and I think he understands the fact that stuff happens, and even though we're not prepared to do it, it could be things like a partial panel or a failed instrument or a failed vacuum pump, as happened to me last week or two, or just stresses at home where we feel like we can't do it. Let me just tell you one last quick story. I had an instrument student, we laugh about this today, who was totally lost. He got totally lost on an instrument approach to a little town called Olean. We were in solid IMC conditions. Mm-hmm. He says, I can't do it, Bob. I'm lost. And he says, you're going to have to take it. And I said, I can't. And he says, take it. He says, I'm frustrated. I am lost. I can't do it. I said, I won't take it. Mm-hmm. And then he said, I could see he was getting angry. And I said, well, I said, friend, just imagine the following scenario. And I will quote, Dear Mrs. So-and-so, I regret to inform you that your husband died while trying to find his way to the Olean Airport, signed the FAA administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he said, yeah, what would I do if I was up here by myself?
Right.
And I says, we have 2 hours worth of gas left. I'm not going to do a thing. You're going to work the problem. You know, eventually he found his way around. He talked with ATC. He got vectors to where he needed to go, and he landed the airplane safely. And I think that extra jolt of confidence that came from being forced to do it, operating outside of his own perceived envelope, if you will, made him a far better pilot.
You know, Bob, I can't imagine ever talking to ATC on those topics unless some instructor did what you did. I mean, so many people have mic fright coming into flight training. Most of them get over it, at least to the extent they can function at a normal level. But if you're in a situation where you can't find the airport and you're going to need that kind of help, that's got to be a very, very difficult thing to do for the first time when you're alone, to ask for vectors and follow them.
Well, I mean, I'm not taking credit for this, but it would have been very easy for me to, you know, say, all right, now this is how we're going to get back. But that would not have served the student, and he overcame. I mean, he just figured out how to process this and realized that no matter how lost we are, there's always an out. There's always a safe way home as long as we can keep the airplane upright and have enough fuel. I was out with doing some approaches at the Rochester Airport here this past weekend, and I was listening to the frustrations of an air traffic controller talking with an instrument pilot who was not doing very well on the radio. Finally, the controller says, do you have an instructor on board? And the student said, yes, I do. And he says, well, let the instructor do the radio work. And I sort of cringed when I heard that. And the instructor did. The instructor picked up and did all the radio work. And I said to myself, you know, how is this student going to ultimately learn if an impatient controller was not willing to work with him? And it wasn't as if the airspace was alive with conflicting traffic. It was just a case where the controller had grown weary of repeated calls to the student, and the instructor quite readily stepped in and took over. And I think that was really kind of a bad example. We just really should have just forced the student to listen up, pay attention, and would have become a better pilot as a result.
Well, this may be one of those situations. I liken it to when people are learning to drive a car, and this doesn't happen much anymore, but years ago you used to face the choice of, will I learn to drive with an automatic or with a manual transmission? For some students, learning to drive with an automatic was just a necessary thing. You had to get to the point where you were you had committed a lot of those skills to reflect or to subconscious memory before you could add another layer of skills on top of it. Other people could jump right in and seem to master both simultaneously. But, you know, this may just have been one of those situations where someone's particular learning curve steepness was they were set up to be a candidate for not being a 40-hour private pilot.
Well, yeah, and the example you use about the automatic and the standard transmission is exactly where we are today in many aspects of flight training, the old round gauges versus the glass cockpits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching in glass cockpits, but I know I have to equip my students to fly on the round gauges. And I tell them, you're going to have to learn both until eventually the round gauges go away, just like, well, standard transmissions haven't gone away, but you can, you know, the preponderance of automobiles today are automatic. So I don't fear that my 18-year-old daughter doesn't know how to drive standard. She can barely drive automatic. Between you and me.
All right.
But,
just between you and me, Bob. Nobody's here in this. Just between you and me. Well, listen, we need to take a break here, but I want to come back and talk about a unique educational opportunity that's available through Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated. In association with Utah Valley College. This is this busted an old myth, apparently, that I was holding on to, and we'll talk more about it in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves and of the Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated Flight School, which is based at the Lancaster Airport near Buffalo, New York. And Bob, you've had your training facility up and running for a few months now. And I noticed in the current edition of Over the Airwaves, you announced a unique affiliation with Utah Valley State College. And I thought this was remarkable because I know you are set up under Part 61 rather than Part 141. Tell us about how this affiliation works.
Well, under Part 61, typically students are not eligible, and this is widespread belief, are not eligible for federal financial aid if they're attending a college and pursuing aviation studies and then go out to a flight school and take flight instruction. Generally speaking, it was thought that you would have to be a Part 141 school, an FAA-approved Flight 141 school, in order to be eligible for federal aid. Utah Valley State College, however, is making that aid available through their institution to students coming to Bob Miller Flight Training under Part 61. So that was one reason I wanted to affiliate with them, because I do work with a lot of young people, a number of whom are attempting or wanting to become professional pilots. But they would have to leave and run over to the Part 141 school to qualify for aid. And this is no longer the case.
Well, this is really interesting because I know a lot of our listeners, Bob, are at the age where they are not in their early college years. In other words, if they're talking about college, They're talking about going back as a non-traditional student or continuing ed. And this looks to me to be a really intriguing proposition for someone in that situation, because Utah Valley State College has most of its curriculum and apparently its entire aviation science curriculum available online.
That's right, and that's what makes it possible. And offering it online under their global aviation program, of course, it makes no difference where on the globe you take it, you are able to obtain the courses at the same tuition level that you would if you were an in-state resident in the state of Utah. Keep in mind, this is a Utah public college. So where you might expect to pay $22,000 a year in tuition at a private four-year college campus, you can take the same course load online for $1,600 to $1,800, a considerable savings. The only requirement is that you're able to discipline yourself to take courses online as opposed to attend a classroom someplace.
Well, and as I can attest, not all of us are set up to do that. I know that I do much better in a classroom environment than I do in a distance learning situation, but I also am becoming a Utah resident this month, so I'm going to check this out in more detail, and I thank you for bringing it to my attention. Well, Bob, we always appreciate these Monday chats on safety topics, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Paul. See you soon.
You can find Bob Miller's writings at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.